Folks, hi, this is Elvin Shamroth. We're going to begin our teleconference right now. And for those, I guess, 85-90% of you who have handed in your cases, well done. We're past the first deadline, and I'm sure you're feeling a tremendous relief off your shoulders. For those of you that are still using the second deadline, try and get it done as soon as possible, obviously. And even though you're paying a little bit extra for that second deadline, if you can get it finished a week before the deadline, that's also a good thing, because it allows you to start working on oral exam issues and oral exam technique that much sooner. And that's where we shift at this point in time, from case list construction to case list review and oral exam technique. So what we're going to do from now on is, many of you will still find questions or concerns that you've got on your case list, and it's going to make you even more anxious now because your case list is cast in stone and you can't change it. I will just share with you that 99.9% of the time, this is not a problem. It's typically very easy to, without being dishonest, but in a very open and honest fashion, with your examiner what your thoughts are. So that's what we will talk more about. And I also want to start emphasizing oral exam technique. So I'm going to ask you folks be comfortable to volunteer on the hot seat, because it's really, really good practice to have this mock oral exam exposure. And as you folks know, I keep this anonymous. No one will know who you are. And so even if you don't know an answer to a question that I might ask, no one's going to know who you are. So it's really a comfortable environment, and you'll gain tremendous experience from having exposed yourself to this environment. I want to encourage you all to do it. I know virtually all of you say, I'm not yet ready. I will tell you, you will never feel ready. And so I advise you to get started as soon as possible. Volunteer, and I'd be happy to chat with you in that environment in the upcoming teleseminars. But with that out the way, we still have a couple of issues that I want to talk about. And we have one person who submitted some questions for our teleseminar today. And I understand the name is Chantip. Chantip, are you there? Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. Thank you so much. And thank you for bringing this question to us. It's I will tell the group listening in that probably only 15% of you, 20% of you also have this actual kind of issue on your case list, but 99% of you have the potential to have the conversation that we're going to discuss on your cases, because you've all got varying degrees of preterm labor, and that's, you'll see where this is going. So Chanta, I know what your question is because I received your email. Thanks again. But for the sake of everyone listening in, can you just pose your question to us, and then we can talk about it?
Yeah. So I have actually have three patients in my list that is like patient has a pre-viable PPROM, and pre-viable PPROM, I have three patients. One of them is 21 weeks. 22 weeks, and then the 17 weeks. I know that this sounds pretty similar, but I think the most important thing to defend these cases are kind of like how you counsel a patient and the discussion about the medical termination, discussion about the suction D&E. I think these are something that we don't do all the time, and I think a lot of people will feel uncomfortable. So that's why I think it is difficult for me, and I wanted to bring this up to the floor.
Okay, so look, you're quite right. These are important cases, and it's amazing that you've got three cases so close to each other, but each with a slightly different status. So let's go through it. Let's take the 17-weeker.
Okay. So I
realize this is moot now because your case lists are by and large in, but anything that's less than 20 weeks is not an OB case, strictly speaking a GYN case. Now, some of you are having cold shivers going down your spine as you hear me say that because you did it the other way around. It's not the end of the world. Okay, but if you put it on the G1 list and it was OB, doesn't mean to say they can't ask you the G1 aspects at a corrected G1 gestational age and vice versa. They can just change the age by a couple of weeks and say, all right, now if this were a G1 case, what would you do? Or if now this was an OB case, they would make it 22 weeks, what would you do? So they can change it. It's very easy. But look, as a G1N case, in all three of these cases, the key issue that you need to be comfortable to discuss with your examiner is how you counsel the patient. And look, this is a very tough situation when you're on the cusp of viability. I'm giving you my perspective, and I'm not saying it's my way or the highway. But I think the majority consensus would agree with what I'm saying. I don't think there's anyone at 17 weeks of gestation with PPROM would turn around and suggest counseling for viability and a live baby. And I think everyone is going to, it sounds harsh, but basically write the pregnancy off, write the baby off. It's not viable. It's not going to get to viability. And to be quite frank, even if by some miracle it did, the longevity and quality of life would be dismal at best. So the conversation becomes counseling and the different methods of terminating a pregnancy. In your case, in mid-trimester, and they can then, from that, go to a conversation of what are the pros and cons of a first versus a second trimester termination of pregnancy. So that's probably where the conversation would go, and the different techniques. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to get involved in the technical aspect of doing a DNE, but you've got to be able to describe how can you be certain that you got all the fetal parts out, which is a key thing, and that there's no retained product. Now, that's the 17, 18 weaker. What about the 20, 21, 22 weaker? So it depends what the cutoff for viability is in your state, in your hospital, what their abilities are to handle these babies is. And I'm not going to say tonight whether the cutoff is 24, 23, 22, or 20. I'm not going to say that. That's an issue for you given where you're working and the circumstances thereof. But I do want all of you to be able to handle the conversation of management of a woman with PPROM on the cusp of viability. So number one, the biggest question is how do you counsel the patient? And you've got to be comfortable to say what the positives versus the negatives might be. How does maternal age play into this? How does a past obstetric history play into this? Is she a para zero or a para five? There are a lot of variables. And also, on the neonatal side, you've got to be comfortable to describe what kind of morbidity or mortality the patient is looking at with respect to her baby. Now, in this regard, you need to know what are the, and I've mentioned this before in a previous teleseminar, what are the neonatal complications of severe prematurity? And it's jaundice, NEC, IVH, all those abbreviations, sepsis also, PDA, NEC I think I mentioned. Be able to mention those things, okay? And you've also got to be able to describe what kind of a prognosis, mortality-wise, can you offer this mother? And in this regard, I want to encourage all of you to sometime between now and your exam, just pick up the phone and speak to your neonatologist, depending on what level nursery you have. Speak to your neonatologist and say to them, what are the statistics that your nursery can offer for a baby born at 20 weeks or 24 or 28? And you don't have to know every single gestational age, but at least I would encourage you to know at least one number. And I think a good number, if you're going to remember just one, is let's say discharged home alive. That's a pretty reasonable statistic. What is the statistic for discharged home alive at 24 weeks? Because if you don't know the answer to that question, how can you counsel your patients adequately? So you need to have that number at the back of your head without any problem. So you've got to talk about morbidity and you've got to talk about mortality. The next thing that may often come up, and the examiner may ask you, well, let me pose it to you, Chanta. If you had a patient with PPROM at 22 weeks or 23 weeks, would you, or to what extent might you monitor the baby?
So for monitoring the baby, I don't, in my hospital, we do not like do a continuous monitoring like the one after viability. The only way that we do it, we do a drop tone just to make sure the baby is still alive like before we counsel the patient.
Okay, so that's the correct answer. The minor trap that the examiner might try and set for you is to ask you that question. And you would say, you might say something like, Chantip answered the question correctly, but you might say, I put her on the monitor for an hour every 6 hours or once a day or whatever. And the truth is, first of all, a monitor is not very reflective of fetal well-being necessarily at that very premature age. But more importantly, there's a piece of the puzzle that's missing. If the mother turns around and says, I want you to do everything to save the baby, then that may be appropriate. But if the mother says, I'm writing this pregnancy off, it's tragic, but that's it, then there's no point in monitoring the baby, except, as Chantip said, to see if the baby's dead or alive, because if the baby's dead, the status of how you might manage that situation would change slightly. So don't say you would, and this is the point to everyone listening, don't say you'd monitor the pregnancy unless you know that the mother wants you to do everything heroic that you can, okay? I'm reminded that when you're speaking of complications of doing a C-section at such a young gestational age, it's not only neonatal complications, but please don't forget to add in your counseling that in all probability, you're going to land up delivering this baby by C-section, and it's going to be a classical C-section, which means she's compromised for all future pregnancies. So the stakes are very high, obviously. We all know that. There's one more. Again, I want to emphasize, counseling is the major part of this issue, okay? And the technicalities of how you go about inducing labor, when, How do you monitor these mothers? How do you diagnose chorioamnionitis? I'm not getting into the hard technical, the hardcore technical stuff, because I'm pretty sure most of you are very comfortable with that. But I do want to add one more piece, and that is, and I'm going to throw this out to you, Chantip. Let's see how you do, okay?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, before I throw that out to you, often these babies have lousy APGAR scores, no surprise. Be able to discuss, one, what is the significance of a lousy one-minute APGAR score, which is almost nothing. It's got very little clinical significance. And number two, if you've got a five-minute APGAR score, I believe it's four or less. Chantip, if you know, and I'm wrong, please feel free to correct me. But I believe if the five-minute APGAR is four or less, you should continue with a 10-minute APGAR score. So if you've got a five-minute, any of you listening in, if you've got a five-minute APGAR, which is five or less, strictly speaking, you should have had a 10-minute APGAR. If you didn't put that down on paper, it's not the end of the world. Just say, I can't recall specifically, but I believe the 10-minute was seven or whatever the case may be. But you can always add it after the fact verbally. So don't feel bad. Just be aware that, wow, I didn't see on that case number 23, there's a five-minute APGAR of four. I need to just remember to give them verbally what the 10-minute is, okay? So that's the second piece that you need to remember. And the third piece, I'm going to throw it out to you, Chantip, see how you handle this. And I'm giving you full warning, it has the potential to make you feel very bad, and this is why I'm not using your last name, okay? But everyone else is going to feel equally bad because they probably won't, the vast majority won't know the answer. Chantip, give me the strict definition of parity and gravida.
Okay.
Yeah, you see the response. This is classical. Go ahead. Give it your best shot.
Gravity and parity.
Yes.
Real question.
Yes.
So gravity is pretty much the number of times that the patient has ever been pregnant, either with the outcome of term, preterm, miscarriage, ectopic, molar pregnancy, any type of pregnancy. So that's the number of gravity. And then
I'm going to come back to that because you're basing one minor caveat. But go ahead. Let me hear parity, and then we'll come back to gravity.
So parity, I think it is... I don't know, how do I say it differently from the gravity?
You see, the point that I want to make, folks, and I love asking this question, because we all know the big stuff, but very often we forget the little stuff. And this is a classical example of that. You ask any medical student this, they'll rattle it off in their sleep. But we tend to forget this. But in a case of periviability, PPROM, this can come up in the exam. So that's why I want all of you listening in to be totally comfortable to handle that question. So give us your best shot on parity.
Parity, from what I understand, well, there are four numbers, and it's literally what I just said for gravity. So I don't know if I just like making.
Okay, let's make it easy. Let's assume it's the one-digit figure. How would you define parity as a one-digit number?
It will be the number of living.
I'm going to put you out of your misery. I'm going to give it to you. Okay. With respect to parity, it is the number, and they're key words here, the number of completed pregnancies, that went beyond 20 weeks. Okay? So that's why it excludes all the abortions and ectopics and molar pregnancies. Okay?
Okay.
Gravida is all the pregnancies of any kind whatsoever, including the present one. Parity doesn't include the present one. And you knew that.
Yes.
I mention this. I want all of you to be comfortable to talk about that. Okay?
Okay.
All right. So chance of I've discussed with you and everyone listening in the kind of things you need to know with respect to peri-viability. Do you have any questions on your end in this regard?
So for me, I think it's more like a counseling because what I put in my case list, I don't put much word in my counseling. I literally just said counseling. And then
no, that's perfect. Yeah, that's exactly right. You want them to ask you, well, how did you counsel? You're seeding the examiner's mind perfectly, and that's great. I don't want you to put it all down on paper. If you do that, you've left yourself nothing to say in the exam. So that's fine.
Yeah.
But you've got to be prepared to discuss the risks, benefits, and the alternatives. And those include alternatives of aggressive management and passive management. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big discussion. Okay? Anything else?
Yeah. Yeah, I just want, so I practice my counseling in this type of patient, and I have some bullet points that I want to talk about. Like, I put it like a framework of how I would counsel this patient.
Go ahead,
like,
yeah.
The first thing that I would say is I would discuss with the patient about the complication that is associated with peri-viable preprom to mom. The second bullet will be to baby. And then I would discuss with the patient about, like, the management. If the patient were to desire expectant management or, like, wait and see, and then there's a bullet point on to talk about the termination of pregnancy, and that will give me two things to talk about, which is termination with medication and termination with D&E. And also I would like to say that after all this counseling, I would also consult maternal fetal medicine and NICU. And with the shared decision-making, with the multidisciplinary meeting with the patient, me, NICU, and MFM, whatever the patient would like to do, I would I pretty much do what the patient would like to do and then go from there. So that is the framework that I would like to say when it comes to counseling.
Two comments. Number one, You might bring in the neonatologist and the MFM, but at the end of the day, and that's good and that's fine, and I want you to say that it's all good. But at the end of the day, the examiner will say to you, yes, but what would you do if you're working in a very rural hospital and you don't have these these extra specialists to help you? How would you handle it? So you've got to be able to address it on your own. That's all I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other thing I just wanted to mention quickly, what I like, and all of you heard it, and the way Chanta presented this answer, and it's really good, and I would encourage all of you to try and do this as much as you can, and that is, look at the conversation from 30,000 feet and give, to the extent that you can, it's not always easy, but to the extent that you can, give some structure to your answer and then drill down as you go into each aspect. But she said, you know, the first thing I'd divide into this and that, and she's got in her head bullets, which is a great way to do it. The reason why it's so nice is because for the person receiving that, in this context, your examiner, it shows the examiner you've got a very ordered way of thinking and a very logical way of thinking, and it comes across very well. So to the extent that you can do that, I would encourage you to do that. It really is very good. Sorry, Chanta, I interrupted you. There was something else I think you wanted to say.
Oh, no, no, no. No, you're great. I'm listening right now.
Okay, so that was it. I'm done. Good. Were there any other comments or questions that you had?
Oh, I would just want to say one thing. This is something that
yes.
I learned from my reading. Not that I have talked to the neonatologist, which is a good point that you mentioned that we should talk to the neonatologist. There is a calculation. There's a calculation from the NIH. I don't remember the website, but this is like the website that I use to counsel the patient. It pretty much you have to give the gestational age, the baby's gender, the weight, and to put in the checklist if the baby had steroid or not. And with that, it will give you the percent, like
I wasn't aware of that. That's great. Where did you find this?
Yeah.
Where did I find?
Okay, I can look it up right now. It is called. One second.
And while you're doing that, I will just mention there's one thing I forgot to mention, and Chantip just did it now. Obviously, you've got to be prepared to talk about steroids. That goes without saying. So that gets added to the mix. If you can't find it now, not the end of the world, but do me a favor, send it to my office in an email, attention Dr. Shamroth. I'll make sure it gets out to everyone because I think it's nice. It's nice to be able to mention it. Whether you use it or not is not critical, but it's nice to say, you know, there's an algorithm which gives you a decent prognosis reality for various variables, and it's nice to be able to add that.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
I think this is what I am planning to say in my counseling, but I would just say, like, there's a calculation from the NIH that you can put in this parameter, and it will give you the statistic. But
yeah, that's good enough, actually. Yeah.
Oh, okay. But this calculation, it doesn't give you the percent of the discharge home, that one that you mentioned. So I think this is something
that
we have to talk
about. That question for discharge home is a separate issue because that's a function of the hospital where you're working. It sounds to me like the algorithm you were talking about was a function of the fetal and maternal status. It didn't take into account the level of nursery that there might be in existence, for example, whether a transfer was going to be required. So it's a different question, is all I'm saying.
Okay.
They're two separate questions. Chantip, any other questions on your end?
Yeah, I have a question, actually.
From
my understanding, I don't know if this is correct because I never seen this myself. But when I counsel the patient about medical termination, like we all know that it will take longer time versus D&E. D&E has less time, kind of less complication, less bleeding, less infection. But for the induction of labor, I have a patient who she preprom at 22 weeks, and she has a too large fibroid in her lower segment. Like it was 5 centimeter at her lower segment times 2, and she wanted a D&E. But in my practice, I do D&E up to 16 weeks, but I have a partner who do D&E up to 22. So I like referred her to that specific partner, but then she looked at the patient's review ultrasound. It's like, oh, there's two huge fibroid. And because of that, they were like scared of doing this D&E, and we ended up talking the patient into doing medical induction. And with my medical induction counseling, it took me some time to review this with this patient because I was also concerned that my medical induction protocol would not be successful. Like I know that when I read at ACOG said like you can use this 800 micrograms followed by 400 micrograms Q3, maximum of 5 doses, and then you can give the patient a break of 12 hours and you repeat it again. So that was something that I was reading, and I was like, okay, what if I give 5 doses and nothing happens and the baby does not come down or whatever reason because the fibroid is obstructing labor. So I was scared about that, and I was talking to the patient about the medical induction. And with my medical induction counseling, I have to talk about the complication of it. And one of the things that I mentioned to the patient is that failed medical induction. If that were the case, then you have to do DNA. But then
correct.
I kind of feel
that
like...
That was going to be my question. I was going to force you. I was going to tell you, what if the induction failed, the medical induction failed? What are you going to do? So tell me. I want to hear it.
Yeah, so that's the problem. That's why I want to talk about this patient, because...
Okay, so look, this is a bigger issue, and I'm pleased you brought it up, because a lot of you... No, let me refresh. A significant percentage of you, not a majority, are going to face a question like this philosophically, but not in this exact context. That you can be presented with a situation where you wanted to do method A, it didn't work, and the way you presented it, your colleagues had a look, they weren't comfortable, so we went with method B. If method B doesn't work, you've got to resort to something. And you know, the situation becomes more and more emergent and dire and severe. And so you get license to be increasingly more aggressive. And it might, I mean, it theoretically could be that she fails medical therapy, she fails DNE. What are you going to do then? And I would argue, you know, you've got these fibers, you can't get around them. You may be forced to do a hysterotomy, heaven forbid, to evacuate a uterine cavity contents. I don't know the answer to that question, but the point that I want to make, when all of you have the potential to be exposed to this kind of question, they can present you oftentimes an extreme emergency situation. And that's what we're describing here. And you can't send this patient home. You've got to do something. You've got to, at the very least, stabilize her. So the question is a fair one in these extreme cases. What are you going to do? And I would hold that, I mean, and I could be wrong because I don't have any experience in this. But to my thinking, maybe in that extreme situation, hysterotomy would be a consideration. Because shy of that, the next thing you're looking at is hysterectomy, and that would be outrageous. So unless you can come to me with some other more conservative approach, I think that's the next thing on the line. And and you need to be comfortable to say this kind of thing in the exam. You say, you know, philosophically, I'm going to try the most conservative thing possible. So I'm going to start with A. If that doesn't work, I'll go to B. If that doesn't work, I'm in a very dire situation. And now I'm going to have to be that much more aggressive. And in this clinical situation, I may even have to consider a hysterotomy.
Okay.
Don't suggest hysterotomy first. They will fail you if you do that, obviously. Okay?
Right.
But when the chips are down and you've tried everything else, that may become the last resort for you, and then that becomes legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to explain the philosophical scenario. Like I said, for all of you listening in, very few of you will have it in this precise clinical setting, but the principle is relevant to all of you. So, Chantip, you're okay with that?
Yes, I'm okay with that. That's
okay.
Really great.
I'm going to have to finish off now. I've got a quick question for you. Did you find this helpful?
Yes.
You can say it was
helpful.
A waste of time. I don't mind. I always ask candidates to say it, because to everyone listening in, I want you to hear the sense of value from the person in the hot seat, because I want to encourage all of you to volunteer, especially now as we go into oral exam technique time. It's an opportunity, a free mock oral exam exposure, and free is good. So please volunteer. We can take two people. Rarely we will get three. And this year, you folks have been very shy about volunteering. I don't know why, but I want to encourage you to volunteer. You saw I never use the candidate's last name, so you'll always remain anonymous. Okay, just keep that in mind. Before I sign off, I want to remind all of you again, I believe I mentioned it 2 weeks ago, ABOG did something unique and released and after the fact, additional article that they wanted everyone in the maintenance of certification program to read. And because they did that, you can pretty much read into it that ABOG thinks it's a very important subject. If it's an important subject and your examiner has read this article, it behooves you to be able to talk about it. So just again, I'll repeat, it's an article on syphilis. So please, I want to encourage every one of you to be comfortable to handle a conversation on syphilis. You don't need to discuss how you did a thesis or wanted to do a thesis on syphilis. That's not required. But if a conversation on syphilis comes up, I want you to be comfortable to handle yourself. That's all. Okay? So keep that in mind. Okay. The next thing I want to mention is we're going to do our next live in-person Definitive Board Prep course in It's going to be next week Sunday in Baltimore. And then 2 weeks later, we're doing it again in Los Angeles. We will only have one more course about 2 weeks later thereafter in, I think, the second week of September in Baltimore again. But I want to encourage you, if you're thinking of attending one of these courses, come sooner rather than later. You'll be very pleased that you did because you will gain insights that you never had before, and it'll help you as you prepare in your remaining weeks and months for the exam. So if you are planning on coming, register and come as soon as possible. It's also available online, which obviously is a lot more convenient, but we do encourage you to come in person. We feel so much so that we make it cheaper to be in person than online, and you get a better feel when you're in the in-person course than when you're at home. It's difficult to concentrate 8 hours a day, without any distractions. When you're watching a TV at home, it's a lot easier at the course. So I want to encourage you folks to come to the course if you can. So with all that being said, the next teleseminar will be on the 24th of August, which is three weeks from today. And I'm guessing it's because the LA course will be in 2 weeks' time. That's probably what it is. So the next teleseminar will be on the 24th of August, and we'll do this all again. Please volunteer to be on the hot seat. It's well worthwhile. With that being said, Shantav, thank you very much again for volunteering. To the rest of you, thanks for joining, and we'll tell your friends about us. We'll do this all again on the 24th of August. Thank you so much, folks. This then concludes the teleconference. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you.